We're delighted to have Boundless Way Dharma teacher Jeff Sewell joining us this evening. Jeff has been vice president of the Leadership Council, and I've had the opportunity to work with him over the past couple of years, and have so appreciated Jeff as someone who can think about situations from different perspectives. And indeed, part of what Jeff does in the world is he has been part of conversations to reduce conflict in South Africa and Southeast Asia and Israel, and has really put himself out. So we're delighted to have you here speaking about beneficial action.
Thank you very much. It's so lovely to be here. Really just had a wonderful feeling walking in the door and, you know, seeing you. And I'd love to spend more time here, but it's really wonderful to know that you're here practicing in this space. So when I first read this little Dogen passage about beneficial action a few weeks ago, the words moved to do so leapt out at me. They did not expect a reward. They were moved to do so only for the sake of beneficial action. In my experience, it's very easy to allow oneself to get sort of tracked into commitments, be it a job or some other activity that does not feel like the deepest expression of who I am. And perhaps a little counterintuitively, one manifestation of this in my experience has been times when I've actually felt moved to do something that wasn't particularly civic oriented, where I had doubts about whether it was the best and highest use of my energies, talents, whatever, for the benefit of others. One example of this in my own life was about 15 years ago. It relates to what David just said in the introduction. I had a sort of developing career teaching and practicing in the conflict resolution arena, and along came an offer to join a tech startup. and I have to say, what I was really, really moved to do at the time was to join the tech startup. It was just this organic feeling of enthusiasm about doing that. And I agonized over this decision for months. And in the end, I did it. I joined the tech startup, and I did it, I have to say, with some, not so small measure of, doubt and feelings of guilt. That it was a kind of cop-out, a betrayal of principle. But the energy behind it, the movement to do it, was so irresistible that I just knew I had to do it. And I did. And in retrospect, I have to say, it was great. It was absolutely an excellent move at that life stage for me. And there were some big, fantastic surprises as a result of it. Maybe 6 months after I joined this company, and shortly after we released our first product, which was a software program, a secure online collaboration program, this South African guy walked into our office, and this was roughly around late 2000, and he said, "Hey, I'm an early adopter of your software program, and I have a few feature requests. I'd like you to help me." He said, "You won't understand anything about my world, but I've got this big, complicated collaboration problem I'm working on, and if you can help me, you know, maybe it'll advance your product in a way that will be useful to other people." And then he proceeded to explain, this man's name is Hannah Siebert, that he had just been appointed the neutral facilitator in Sri Lanka, where there was a raging civil war at the time, as you know. And this following a major impasse in a peace process that had faltered. And since his appointment, he hadn't been able to get the parties talking face-to-face yet, but he had revived the peace process online using our software. And I just about fell out of my chair. I said, "I do understand." and we can help. And we did. Our software became evolved, you know, thanks to the help of him and other early adopters, and it became central to the peace process in Sri Lanka. It was even used in nationwide election monitoring that included Jimmy Carter. And it also marked the beginning of what has now been a long-term, deep friendship and collaboration with this remarkable peacemaker, and involvement in the organization that he founded earlier that year, the year I met him, co-founded with some other people, including five Nobel Peace Laureates. And really a big surprise coming from this movement, from this decision. And I realized that, you know, not every story like this resolves in this way. I mean, it was just incredibly fortuitous that Hannes walked into our office that day. But the general point for me, the bigger point, is really that there's integrity in trusting these movements. In my experience, and things like sitting and koan work, and mainly, I think, just living life, have helped me to learn that it can be really dangerous to try to force answers to the big questions in our lives. The answers that are right generally feel right, and they may seem to arise spontaneously, be spontaneous, another word we see in the Stogen passage, but often that spontaneity is preceded by a long time of sitting, often uncomfortably, with the question, perhaps years. And the right answers to these big questions often feel like a deep, deep expression of who we really are, in my experience. In my experience, sometimes things don't work that way at all. After we sold that tech company I joined, I had to decide what to do next. And the thing I really wanted to do at the time was go run, having had this experience at a small tech company, a startup. And I had several opportunities to do so. And the ones that I was most drawn to would have required a move or some other a disruption, some other sacrifice that my wife would have had to make. She was on the tenure track at the university where she teaches. She had not yet received tenure. And the things that I was most moved to do at the time all would have required some major disruption in her career. And the thing that I I most wanted to do it was this tech thing. I couldn't do it. And the thing I least wanted to do, I probably had 12 options between the tech company and the thing I least wanted to do, was join a large law firm. And all things considered, that ended up being what I felt I needed to do at that time. And I did it. And it's been great. absolutely an excellent move. and there have been some big, fantastic surprises. My firm has been very supportive of this conflict resolution work and has even, you know, provided pro bono services in support of our projects at times. Turns out I've been able to participate not just being the lawyer to, but actually being invited to be a part of not one, but several young tech companies by serving on their boards. Some of these companies I never would have encountered if I hadn't made this move. And other interesting opportunities, you know, kind of are arising. And not unimportantly, I'm deeply, deeply happy in my marriage. back when I was deciding between teaching and that first tech startup, you know, it was such a terrible decision. It seemed like, you know, there was an apple and an orange. I liked both, and I didn't have any way to make a fruit salad. And from this vantage point, you know, that fruit salad that started with an apple and an orange just seems to be getting more colorful and more delicious. It seems that fruit salads, you know, really can happen, though I didn't believe it at the time. You know, on the one hand, I think Dogen is saying in this passage there is integrity at times in doing what we feel most moved to do. And on the other, I hear him saying, there is integrity at times in doing, in not doing what we most feel moved to do. I see him saying here something very much like what he seems to be saying in a piece of his, you know, lovely shorter precepts, list or construction. In introducing the precept of not sparing the Dharma assets, he says, you know, making use of all the ingredients of my life, I vow to take up the way of not sparing the Dharma assets. You know, the ingredients of our lives include the opportunities we have, our likes, our preferences, our mainstream or offbeat interests, and they also include our perceived constraints, our dislikes, others' interests and priorities. And Dogen seems to also be telling us that at times we never can control, let alone, or predict, let alone control the future, and at times putting others' interests first is the most reliable guide. The Lord of old gets up three times, interrupts his dinner three times, interrupts his bath three times to wholeheartedly help others. The trick, of course, I think, and it is tricky, is knowing what to do in any given situation. And Dogen is here offering us two, I think, helpful decision principles. On the one hand, you know, do what moves us. On the other hand, act primarily for others' benefit. And it's lovely when those two principles seem to align in some choice that's available to us, but in my experience, it often doesn't feel that way. And it's been helpful for me to remember that I just might be surprised by what follows that first step. And that the best we can do at any given time is just try to make good use of the ingredients of our lives. Acting with good intention, knowing and trusting that whatever we do from this frame of mind and heart is an act of oneness that benefits self and others alike.
Thank you.
So, thanks so much, Jeff. Yeah. It's great to have your voice added to the richness of this exploration. So, I think you might be the only one who doesn't know what happens next, which is just that we do Dharma dialogue now. And first we go around and say our names. So, I'm Melissa.
Steve.
Fran.
Matt.
Ray.
Diane.
David.
And Jeff.
So this is a time for people to ask questions, say reflections, whatever's up for you about the talk or about the topic or about your practice.
And Jeff, thank you so much for sharing so much of your life. You know, it's just so great that you're, you know, willing to share the personal details of your life, which is so lovely, you know, coming here. Julie Nelson was here talking about the Baskin-Robbins flavors. You know, So tonight, you're the, you know,
the Baskin.
Flavor of the day.
And also just like the, you know, conveying the mystery of the universe. So it was just so poignant how, you know, you made this decision and then the universe came to you and gave you exactly what, you know, you were hoping to receive. And there it responded, you know. So it is, I think, often that we receive gifts from the universe that, you know, we never would have expected, but they're just right for us, you know, whatever that may be. And so just so exciting to listen to that, you know, how it happened, or is still happening for you. Yeah, so.
Yeah, the universe just seems to keep on finding us, doesn't it? That's I feel fortunate to, you know, that it seems to keep finding me. Yeah.
Although as I was listening, I thought, my image is that you could get stuck on a ship with seven people for 6 months wandering through the ocean. You'd come back and said, surprising things. We were playing bridge all, you know. But I think, you know, pointing to that, some kind of openness. Mm. So we have our opinion. This is what I think should happen. And sometimes we get to do that, and sometimes we don't. I love how, you know, illustrating both, but then moving towards it with some kind of openness, or what's here, and
we just really don't know, do we? Like, it's not just a tagline. We just can't know. So I guess it is kind of about the spirit in which we move into, you know, this moment and now. And for me, the set is, I spent last weekend with somebody I'm very close to who does not seem to have that capacity. You know, frankly, it's challenging to be with this person, and it's sad, and I don't really have an opinion on whether this is I don't know. I just think if we have this measure of openness, however we get it, we're so lucky. And it doesn't seem to be entirely cultivated, quite honestly, you know, from my perspective. I think it's gift and genetics and circumstances to no small measure. I just don't know I'm sure there's some test out there that would reduce me to rubble. I don't know if it's the boat, maybe that's strong, and maybe it wouldn't happen. But I just honestly don't know about that either. And how fortunate we are if we do feel that way.
Yeah. One of the other things that I loved about the way you framed this is how you used Dogen as a mirror for your life. And you could really see him. It's just not some abstraction, but it's really on the ground, absolutely real instruction he's giving about life. It's not, you know, it's not some beautiful theory. And that was so clear in the way you used the text. I was very delighted and impressed by that. Because sometimes we forget these ideas, we can get so excited about them. But, you know, on the ground, people in Sri Lanka were really killing each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, people in all over the world are killing each other. And you thought you were going away from that life, which is so interesting, of reconciliation. And really, you know, it almost doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah. Then there's this vast interconnected web, and you thought, you know, I'm doing this for my wife, but really, we just have this little view, and we kind of have to try. This is the faith mind.
Yes.
We just go forward, and then the world does come to us. And you're right. We're lucky that we have the capacity to recognize it when it happens. So thank you for that, for this view.
Mm.
It does seem to me that somehow life always gives you what you need, even if you don't think it's what you need. You know, I've had surprises in my life too, and the sort of surprise I would never have asked for or wanted, and yet it turned out to be, you know, like an enormous gift.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't take anything for it. You know, I've seen that happen over and over again. And I think, you know, there is something to being open to what life presents.
Yeah.
That maybe is the key there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of... there's the life presenting things, and then there's the capacity to receive, you know, to take in what life presents to us. And that is, you know, what I find particularly sad when you know, a person or a, you know, or a nation or a community or whatever has, through, you know, whatever series of, you know, circumstances and conditions, kind of lost that capacity to receive. And you know, my sense is that it can be regained, but it's the universe, I think, is always right there for us, right? You know, but can we, you know, can trust it?
Right. You know, this topic has come up quite a bit, as you can imagine, with the this particular text, and also with the confluence of events on Monday with the bombing, and some of us were talking. About how, yes, indeed, life gives us what we need, but sometimes there's no possibility for a very, very, very long time, if ever, of recognizing it.
Right.
You know, I think about the people who were injured in the bombing, and you could say, well, they got
you know, they got what they need in some sort of hello? No.
Yeah.
But it's not like a magical, mystical receiving. But it's like, okay, now this, I can't understand it. I'm not going to try to make sense of it, but I have to live with this now. How can I stay open? How can I actually, receive this terrible thing?
Right.
Because people will shut down about receiving good stuff, but we also shut down about receiving terrible things. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the practice is maybe to learn how to take a little pause in the middle of that screaming out in pain.
Yeah.
You know, or just completely being with the screaming out in pain and know that this is the only life that is present right now. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but...
Yeah, and I just think it's so important to say that, too, because, there is this mindset that everything happens for a reason, which is not what you were saying, by any means.
Yeah.
But something my mother-in-law said that time. And that just heaps pain upon the pain, you know?
Right.
And there was... I remember my sister's two-year-old son was killed in a terrible accident, and someone gave her a book that said... why bad things happen to good people, and it just, just heart-wrenching that, people are expected to cover up their pain with this sort of idea that, it doesn't exist, So important to distinguish between that kind of mindset and the mindset where we learn to cultivate openness to what life gives us, and as hard as it can be at times, or openness to our feelings about it, really feeling it,
Anger, I agree.
To let anger be present.
Despair, all of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and I think there is this, when something happens, we have an opinion, we rate it on the scale of like really, really good to total disaster, right? And when it's that opinion, then prevents we can get locked into it. I had to take a job at a big law firm, and life sucks.
Right.
And then we can enact that. And I do think that sometimes the being angry when we're angry, being hurt when we're hurt, having our heart really broken, not trying to covered that over, but that we were talking this morning about the possibility of despair, that it's through the despair that we can maybe get free from some of our opinion, that we get, someone was talking many nights ago now about... I think it might have been last week. But talking about the place where his life got so bad that there was absolutely nothing he could do, and something shifted.
Yeah.
And then it's not like things got better, but it really changed.
It's so... this is a couple things in there just seem so interesting to me, this idea that, closedness is in part about having a narrative, right?
Right.
And
say that again.
Being closed is actually to have a narrative, an opinion.
That's right. Here's what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Naming is such a powerful thing in life, and yet when we name something, we leave a remainder, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing that was so interesting, kind of playing on that I heard in what you said was. Coming to the end, a narrative that somehow, you turn the next page and there's nothing on it, like it ends mid-sentence, I'm just stuck. How that's the stuckness, is such an opportunity, what was it you said? There was this.
Oh, it was so brilliant.
Yeah, well, it was about this. I don't know.
Replay that, Steve.
Yeah.
And anyway, that stuckness may be a real opportunity for someone very lost in,
Yeah.
when I'm lost in my own narratives.
Well, we were talking, you know, the same themes, of course, keep coming up, and this is one of them. And this whole idea that if we're looking for a specific outcome, or, you know, the narrative ends with, and I lived happily ever after, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, I lost all my limbs, but, you know, it was a good experience. You know, I really learned a lot. This has been great, thank you. Or maybe this is not about that, but it's about being fully alive to whatever's here. So that means that if anger's present, you're fully angry. If grief is present, you're fully grieving. If despair is present, if fear is present. And that also means if joy is present, if love is present, you know, that it's all, it's about aliveness. This is, I think, one of the things we said today, this is my recollection, not about being peaceful, not about being calm, not about being happy and everything being okay, but about really being here.
My own experience around these events of Monday, I was at the bombing in Boston. I was, my office was about 2.5 blocks from the finish line.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was there. Our office was not closed. I didn't hear the bombs, but, you know, I heard all the sirens, and, you know, suddenly we're in this time war, you know, zone downtown. And I got out of the city maybe an hour after it happened. And I have to say, for the this is kind of, I think, riffing a little bit on what you just said. My experience personally for the first 36 hours was time warp probably describes it. I mean, it just seems surreal to me. I wasn't sure what I was feeling. It was a little bit of a, you know, state of, you know, shock, even though we weren't directly affected by, and this is a key point. I mean, that's kind of what I kept telling myself. There was this moment when we got the news that the first person who died was an 8-year-old boy. And I got a call from, I learned about that when an aunt called me to ask whether my son, who's almost 8, was okay. Mm-hmm. And we had been trying for hours to get in touch with friends of ours, and one of my son Ellis's best friends and classmates from school, Jeremy, who is 8, was downtown with his father and his little sister to cheer mom over the finish line. And mom was supposed to finish at right about 2:45. And without telling our kids what we were doing, we drove by their house and we found their dog running around aimlessly and their lights off, and we'd been texting them and couldn't get any news. And we thought, you know, it seemed, you know, this is a probability function thing, right? You know, we know the first victim was a boy. It was 8 years old. He was at the finish line at about 2:45. This is not looking good. You know, we're thinking we may have to have a really uncomfortable conversation with our son. In about after a couple of hours of this, we got a text back from Dad saying we're all okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And now I'm back in the frame of mind, we're not affected directly. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of, there's some way in which, you know, compartmentalizing the world, this awful thing happened, I don't know quite, I'm not really feeling a lot about it yet, which just seems weird. Mm-hmm. And then last night I was watching the news late at night, and they, you know, were showing pictures of Mark and Richard, this, you know, this young boy, and I just started to cry. And it's so important to feel something, you know. I'm not using the words anymore. We weren't directly affected. Hard to compartmentalize this as, you know, me and not me, distant and near, you know.
You know, what you describe is what everybody describes when confronted with tragedy like this. The shock, the
could I be affected? The not me. And then this recognition, I think, comes back to the Dharma recognition, mm-hmm. that we are, of course, affected. We're affected by children dying of AIDS in Africa right this second. We're just one person split up into these little parts. But we have this capacity to compartmentalize and to be in shock. And that's how we can go on.
Yeah.
But yeah, the heart breaks as a practitioner of the way.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, I also liked how you talked about beneficial action as really, having something that has energy for you, mm-hmm. that you move into. Because there could be a tendency to think of it as kind of like do-gooding, mm-hmm. When you read it, which is sort of constructed, of the mind. I should do this. This is the right thing. I want to be the kind of person who does this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it has, not beneficial for anybody, I think. Whereas what you were pointing to is, your heart's response mm-hmm. to what arose and going for it, trusting that heart response. And, maybe from the outside, joining a law firm doesn't look like beneficial action. But, here you go. You did you say it wasn't your first choice, it wasn't what had energy, but actually the energy was toward your family and your wife,
yeah.
So that really was where your energy drove you, I think,
mm-hmm.
And so then, the sort of miracle of beneficial action happens for you and them.
Yeah.
But it's a nice way to think about beneficial action. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Well, and I was struck about the first choice about teaching and doing the conflict resolution in the startup, because clearly you made the wrong choice. Right? From this point of view teaching, good, conflict resolution, good, startup, making money, business. And I think, this pointing that this is not about doing good. But it's really hard to trust that when, and it sounds like you agonized with that. But that feels like a very important point.
Yeah. It definitely is for me. I really, really find just so helpful this couple lines from the Sugar Precepts recitation, mm-hmm. That I have to say I reflect on that all the time, making use of all the ingredients in my life. Don't leave any out, I vow to take up the way of not sparing the Dharma assets. What does it mean at this moment not to spare the Dharma assets? And that includes these things, we want to turn away from and these things we're trying to. I mean, for me, I feel personally that's like in all the precepts, that one really, has been for this phase, a long stretch, a very powerful, ingredient.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciated your emphasis on, not being able to know the outcome to these things, and it is, it's so difficult, and it's just like, stuff is unknowable. I mean, there's no way you could have predicted the results of your choice, and there's no guarantee at all that it would work out in a good way. I mean, as I was saying to Melissa the other day, I mean, you can go down to the marathon and go watch your mother run and be blown up. I mean, the universe doesn't necessarily give you anything, and
right.
There are no guarantees.
You still have to act in the face of that not knowing, and even if you you have your your arms blown off, you know, there's still, you know, there's still the opportunity. I mean, it's a, you know, horrible thing that that has happened, and you know, you can't really say to somebody, well, you know, you're going to get some benefit out of this. And yet, you know, there's still, you know, so there's meeting this life, you know, with no arms, you know, and you know, how do I proceed, you know, and there's still the opportunity to practice in pain and still realize that we're producing action and even beneficial action, you know, in those circumstances, and even, you know, being suffering and in pain ourselves, you know, there's still, you know, this opportunity to meet, you know, whatever it is that is here for us, and head in, you know, the direction that we think is best. I, you know, I'm reminded of the thing, the story we talked about a couple times of the little bird, you know, trying to put out the, you know, the forest fire with drops of water, you know, and it keeps flying back and forth trying to put it out, and you know, it's hopeless, you know. But you know, what can you do? You know, this is the thing. This is the only way I can try and reduce the suffering of the world, you know, given the circumstances. And, there you go. You do what presents itself, you know? And like you said, I mean, it's just, you know, sometimes it works out, and sometimes it doesn't work out at all. And you, in both cases, you know, you are headed in the, you know, the direction that you can.
In another Dharma talk, I'll talk about the things that didn't resolve in any, you know, quite like these, but, you know, no, and there have been plenty of those, you know. No, you're so right. I mean, to me, this whole passage is so much about just, you know, it's encouragement to approach each moment with a particular frame of mind and heart, mm-hmm. and, you know, mm-hmm. trusting that, you know, an act coming from that frame of mind and heart is an act of oneness, and not knowing, you know, and not, you know, it's not just sometimes, you know, they did not expect a reward. Really? I think he means it.
Yeah, I think he means it too.
You know, we often subtly expect a reward, mm-hmm. you know, and you're, whether or not, you know, from one perspective, we're always rewarded. And from another perspective, there's a real risk of really no reward. You know, you can view it from both angles, I think, and your reward may be a slap in the face or a missing arm. So, you know, it can't be about anything other than how we approach that moment, right?
How we meet it.
And how we meet the moment, you know. When our face is stinging, you know.
Jeff, thank you so much.